We look at the historical setting of Daniel. I put this in there for the sake of convenience. Because we're going to get into the text today. You see, now you've had a history of Israel, have you not? And so this is not new ground for you, of course. It's just, and of course you've also had my Western Civ 1, and it's so in that introduced you to you. Daniel falls in the period between the fall of Samaria, where really Daniel, about 606 BC, was taken into captivity to Babylon, and the fall of Jerusalem, 587 BC. So you can refer back, that's once you know this is here in the syllabus. Because if you ever get confused about where we should start adding up these years, and it's easy to get confused. We're going to talk about this because Daniel speaks of historical events up through the century that succeed his age. You can just remember this is here, so you can look back and see where you are and how many years are involved. The chronology, turn back to Addendum B. Here's the chronology, and this is what we follow in this syllabus. The chronology of Daniel. Here's how we go. One, chapters one, Daniel raised to power. Two, Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Three, the fiery furnace episode. Four, Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the great tree. The reign of Belshazzar. We skip from chapter four to chapter seven. Then to chapter eight. Then back to chapter five. Then we're down to chapter 9, chapter 6, chapters 10 through 12. The simple reason that Daniel was not chronological. And so I think it would be less confusing to us if we dealt with Daniel chronologically. That's what I noticed.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is this within conservative views, is this the standard chronology?
Yes.
There's no real argument. No problem, no question about that.
No, that's not debatable. It's not debatable. Just dealt with. It's just not chronological.
Liberals might debate it.
No,
they wouldn't place Daniel over there.
Well, that's right. But it's the general chronology of the book is not debated. Also, look down at the bottom. You can see the dates. You all know this is here. In your study, I put this here for your reference. Daniel in the captivity is 605. Then the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel given the high place in court, Amon Marduk, I list the kings of Babylon, Nergal-Sarnessar, vision of the four beasts, vision of the ram and he-goat, 546, Belshazzar's feast, 539, fall of Jerusalem, the fall of Babylon, 538, 539, the vision of the 77s, and then Daniel's last prophecy. See what that is? I think that'll help you too, so you know where we are. Okay, we'll make reference to that later, but just remember that's there. Now, the city of Babylon, you read Addendum C? No. Did I sign that? Read that for next time. Addendum C, the city of Babylon. Okay? Read Addendum C. Now, and read, okay. Now, we come now to chapter 1, Daniel and his friends and positions of power and influence. Let's turn to Daniel 1 and begin. Now, I'm going to move rather quickly because my syllabus is complete, and I think you can refer back you won't have to take a lot of time taking notes. I did most of your note taking for you. Otherwise, we'd never get through Daniel 1 2-hour course or a quarter. Impossible. Okay. First of all, Daniel 1, chapter 1, which is 21 verses, Daniel and his friends win positions of power and influence. It starts out in the third year of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, meet him. Nebuchadnezzar, some places in the scriptures it's Nebuchadrezzar. It's a problem of transliteration. Nebuchadrezzar is probably more accurate, but the traditional, he's come down as Nebuchadnezzar, and it really makes no difference. Just a question of transliteration. Jeremiah uses both equally, and Jeremiah was a contemporary of Nebuchadnezzar, and he used both. Now you understand that the liquids in any language are very hard to transliterate to other languages. It's like the Japanese R and the English L. The Japanese can't say L. You're a rock producer. And in ancients, there's a problem of simply a problem of pronunciation and transliteration. So it's not a question. It's not a textual difficulty. You know what I'm saying? It's not a question of a text. Now, it probably means that the ancient Babylonians, as other peoples did, incorporated divine names into their personal names, or into the throne names, or the professional names. We're going to see that Daniel and his friends had professional names. It probably means Nebo protect the boundary. Nebo is a god, protect the boundary of the kingdom, something like that. We know what Nebo is. Nebuchadnezzar incorporates Nebo, we're sure about that. And it says, and the Lord gave Jehoiada, in verse 2, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and brought the vessels into the treasure of his God. Now, we say about, first of all, let's look at Jehoiada. The date is 605 B.C. You can go back to the chronology in your addendum and trace this down. 605 B.C. Now, keep in mind, Jerusalem fell to Babylon. In 605, it was not destroyed by Babylon as a punishment until 586, 587. So don't get a lot of new students get those confused. They think that Jerusalem fell when that was the beginning of Babylonian rule over Jerusalem. It wasn't. They were conquered and made a tributary state. A tributary, you know, they tribute regularly. And when they didn't pay their tribute, that's when they came in 586, 587 and destroyed them. So don't get those confused. There's a problem. 2 Chronicles 36:6 says, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against him to take Babylon. To take him to Babylon. There's no evidence that Jehoiakim was taken to Babylon in 605 B.C. There's no evidence that he was taken to Babylon. It just says it came to take him. Jehoiakim died in 598. Probably before Nebuchadnezzar could arrive and punish him. Just a problem of working out the chronology here. I indicate the probable solution to this. In 605, Jehoiakim was made a vassal. You know what that is? He had to pay tribute. He acknowledged the authority of Babylon. He opened the gates of the city and offered some of the vessels of Nebuchadnezzar to ransom Jerusalem from destruction. And the text says that Jerusalem was taken at that time, but not destroyed. Perhaps 2 Chronicles 36:6, the statement which I quote for you, gives the added information that Jehoiakim was originally to be sent to Babylon, but he struck a bargain and was allowed to remain on the throne as a vassal. That is, 2 Chronicles does not say, let me summarize for you so you understand this. 2 Chronicles does not say that Jehoiakim was taken into Babylon. It says that the king of Babylon came to take him. And if we put all the events together, what probably happened was he came with the intention of, because Jehoiakim rebelled. See, the prophet told Jehoiakim, pay the tribute, take your medicine, this is the will of God, cure you of your idolatry. Jehoiakim rebelled, king of Babylon came, and with the idea of taking him into captivity and punishing him, blinding him, and him in that way. But Jehoiakim bought him off, submitted, and so as a matter of fact, was not taken into captivity. There's no contradiction in Scripture. They're just these incomplete information. Now we come to the vessels of the temple. This is very critical to understand. And no commentary that you're going to read really captures this, in my opinion. Why does he make this big thing about the vessels in the house, from the house of God? And by the way, sometime during this period, probably before this, the Ark of the Covenant is gone. We never see the Ark of the Covenant after this. Now, it's not mentioned. The fact that it's not mentioned is an argument for silence, which is inherently weak. But these vessels from the temple, he brought them to the land of Shinar, that's Babylon, to the house of his God. Now, this, remember we said last week that the book of Daniel is polemic in nature, the God of Israel against the gods of Babylon. These vessels in the temple are one of the statement that the vessels were taken from Jerusalem to Babylon, out of the temple. This is one of the key statements in the book of Daniel, believe it or not. We sort of read over it. We're going to see these vessels again. Very critical moment.
And I have to know where they are.
Let me see them again. Belshazzar's feast.
Well,
this, I indicate the religious significance of the vessels. They were not merely claiming loot. This was symbolic of superiority or victory of one city god over another. You see, the ancients thought like this. They thought in terms of the gods owned everything. And if you made a treaty with another country, it was not between my country and your country, or my king and your king. It was between my god and your god. And if I made war, my city-state made war with your city-state. It was not what was going on. Ultimately, it was my God was making war against your God. And if I won, that meant my God defeated your God. It didn't mean your God doesn't exist. It means that my God is more powerful than your God.
And they would symbolize that.
How would they symbolize it? They would take the statues, the images of the conquered God, to the temple of the conquering God, and put them in positions of humiliation. Now, we have in Scripture an earlier age of this, a very clear example of this. And who can tell me what it is? The Ark of the Covenant. Remember the Philistines came up and took the Ark of the Covenant back to the house of Dagon, their god. Why? Why did they take the Ark of the Covenant?
Wasn't representing
Israel's
god.
Yes. You see, those that conquered Israel always had a problem because Israel didn't have a statue of their god. Israel was the one nation that could not make an image of their God. And so they took the Ark of the Covenant because that's the closest thing they could come, represented Israel's God. And so God spoke to them in terms of this practice. When the Philistines went out the next morning, what did they find?
In the treasury house of Dagon.
Their God was on his face before the Ark. And they felt bad about that. They got up and dusted him off and apologized.
Went out the next morning, and what did they find? Same thing. So what did they do then? They called Israel and said, come down and meet your God. And they got something, they had a plague on them, and you know the story.
You see, that was that significance. See, this was not simply loot that they were storing.
The significant act was, it was an act of humiliation of Israel's God. They are saying, Israel's God is a pitiful thing. And so they brought, you understand what I'm saying? The act of taking the vessels from the house of God to the house of their God. It doesn't say which God. Undoubtedly, it was Marduk, because Marduk was the chief city god of Babylon, in the house of Marduk, and they insulted him. They were insulting the God of Israel. Very important. Now, the Lord gave, so keep that in mind. The Lord gave Jehoiakim into his hand, our text says, indicating a judgment of God upon Judah's king, who later rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. And you studied this in the Doc Smith Act, the History of Israel, how this was God used Babylon to punish Israel, teach them a lesson, so I'm going to that. There were other vessels taken. In 597, Ezekiel went into captivity, the reference is, I give you here, 2 Kings 24:13. And in 587 B.C., the last of the vessels were taken, the city destroyed. And this is, and I give you the reference in 2 Kings. That is, they came the first time, they came again, they destroyed the city, they take them all at one time, and they would be replaced. What happened was, basically, that God told the kings to submit to Babylon and take their medicine. The kings would not. They kept rebelling. And the Babylonians got sick of threatening and marching over there. And so when they destroyed the city, it was to make an object, it was to make an example of Jerusalem. Put down this nonsense of every time they would back off, why the king would rebel and not send the money. And we're going to come back to Daniel 5. The vessels were returned under Cyrus, under Darius, the Persian rulers, and I give you those references. You can look them up. I'm not going to take time to read that. You understand what I'm doing with the syllabus? So you can, these are references that you can check into them. They're not important enough for us to spend time on, but important enough to be mentioned in the total study. His god, as I've said, is Marduk, most likely, because we know who the chief god of Babylon was. Shinar, the land of Shinar, verse 2, is Babylon. And I give you references in the syllabus where that term is used. Since the Tower of Babel episode, the term Shinar carried the connotation of center of wickedness. Center of wickedness. Later on, Babylon became a code word for any city which is an enemy of the people of God. Thus, in the first century, in the book of in Peter's epistle and in the book of Revelation, what city? Probably in Peter, certainly in Revelation. What book? What city is called Babylon? Rome. Babylon. You are a Babylon. And Shinar meant indicating it was a wicked place. Verses 3-7. So you get the scene here. Now, to keep in mind, the date is 605 B.C. of verses 1 and 2. Before the destruction of the city, and also before Ezekiel was taken, it came in, this happened in waves or a succession of deportations. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and other nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court, in order to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Now, what did... let's skip all the text before us. And the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years. Known as a four-year course, but they may have to summer school. At the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them were the sons of Judah. From the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the names Belteshazzar, incorporating the name Bel, we'll talk about those in a minute, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. Or Abednego, as it's called. Now, let's look at the details in this, following our syllabus. Ashpenaz was the chief of the eunuchs, or the officials. He was an important civil servant, we would call. And he ordered the chief of his officials should be probably nobles. Early such courtesans were made eunuch because of the absence of passion rendered them more dependable. He was a eunuch. Now later on, the word eunuch, they actually were eunuchs at this age. Later on, like the Ethiopian eunuch, they had probably not been castrated. That term eunuch came to mean, to generalize, as this is how language works, to mean any high bureaucratic official. A eunuch. Now, and I mentioned that. Ashpenaz had probably been put in charge of the hostages when Nebuchadnezzar hurried across the desert to claim his throne. What happened was, we know from the cuneiform records, I'll teach you the story, Nebuchadnezzar marched on Jerusalem, but his daddy was king. And while he was, during the after he had taken Jerusalem, they were ready to march the prisoners home over the northern route. As you know, you could not march an army across the desert straight from Jerusalem over to Babylon. You could take a small group, but you could not take an army or a large number of peoples. So what Nebuchadnezzar did when his daddy died, he knew there would be a struggle for the throne. So to get back and claim what he figured was his, he left others in charge of the captives and what they were bringing back, the tributary, and he cut across the desert to a shortcut, a small group. So this Ashpenaz may have been one of those who was left in charge of bringing the captives, these royal captives, back. Now they didn't bring, who did they bring? Well, you know from the biblical record and from the cuneiform records, they didn't bring everybody. They would bring the royalty, and they would bring the skilled people, like people that were useful. The professional class and the artisans, what they would bring. They didn't bring dirt farmers, they had enough of those. Others, okay. The children of Israel says royal family. Josephus claims that these four were made eunuch, but that we don't know that.
Again, this term had probably lost some of its original force. But apparently, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were were descendants of David. That's the most reasonable construction of that understanding of that term of the royal family, descendants of David. They were physically and intellectually superior. Now, what they were doing, listen, was that they would take out of conquered peoples, they would screen them, test them, and find the very best men, and they would use them for what we would call civil servants, as administrators. Now, the reason they did this is that the ancient people found that if they could use Jews to administer Jews, and Edomites to administer Edomites, and so forth, that the people were less restive, that is, the people were less likely to rebel. The Romans did this. That's why Herod was king when Jesus was born. He wasn't a Roman. He wasn't a Jew, but he wasn't a Roman. He's an Idumean. And he's part Jew. You know, and the Romans practiced this in countries that were hard to rule. That is, they tried to do away with an immediate Roman presence in some cases. And so that's one of the reasons they did this. Also, if they could get people who were native, they would be better administrators of these conquered people because they knew the culture. That is, if you're going to rule a group of a tribe or a nation, it's best to have people represent you who know them, know the language, know their customs, what they'll do, what they won't do, how to get the best labor out of them. See what I'm saying? They were sort of, that's what they were. And they didn't do just this. If you notice that's what the text says, they didn't just do this with the Jews. They did it with all the conquered peoples. They would raise up people and select the best from those conquered peoples, make them administrators of those peoples. Government officials. Well, that's pretty clear. Now, it says they were trained in all the literature and language of the Chaldeans, which is synonymous, means the Babylonians. They were not trained as soothsayers, but as upper-level civil servants, as I've said. What was the subject matter? Well, we know from the cuneiform record, they studied language, astronomy, mathematics, natural history, mythological literature, agriculture, and architecture. That was, you understand, we know from the Babylonian records what was the language and literature. Verse 5 says, they were given daily rations from the king's choice food. Now, this was a common phrase in the ancient world, eating at the king's table. It did not mean they ate with the king in some kind of private meal. What it means to eat at the king's table was not to eat with the king. There were thousands of people who eat at the king's table. What it meant was they became the private employees of the king. The king was his. And he fed them. Understand? He provided the food service for them. They didn't eat in the palace. Or, you understand that? Or with, it was not an honored meal. Now, the ancient kings regularly fed large numbers of servants at their personal expense. 3 years was the standard training period in the Persian Empire. This is Babylonian. It may have been standard for the Babylonian Empire as well. I diagram for you the Hebrew, the meaning. What they did, they changed their names roughly to the Babylonian equivalents. Hananiah means the Lord is gracious. The Babylonian name was Shadrach, which probably means command of Aku. Aku is, it's hard to see in English, but that's what it is. Aku is a moon god. Mishael, who is what God is? Mishael, me, who? Who, Ish, Ael, who is what God is? Meshach means who is what Aku is. Sort of translated their names in some way. Azariah, the Lord has helped. Abednego means servant of Nebo. Or Azariah might mean the helper of the Lord. Abed is the Babylonian word for servant. Similar in Hebrew. Abed is the Hebrew word for servant, to serve. Also the Arabic word. Abu ben Adam, may his tribe increase. Abed Adam. Abed means servant. Daniel means God is my judge. His name was changed to Belteshazzar, made Balak protect or something like that. I'm not sure about that. Okay, verses 8 through 16. The Hebrew youths take a stand for their faith and are justified. Now, Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Daniel made up his mind. They changed his name, but they could not change his character. I like that. And it appears that Daniel is the leader, does it not? The others follow in this. Now, why would the eating of the food have been a defilement? Eating of the king's menu. Two possibilities, and maybe both of these. Number one, that the food had been offered to idols. That was very common. Polluted spiritually. I don't like that. I prefer the second alternative. That the food was unclean by Levitical standards. That is, they were serving catfish and crow and all kinds of things they couldn't eat. And not prepared in the proper way. Understand it? So it could have been either one. But there was something about the food that they couldn't eat. Probably it violated the Levitical standard. And I say that because the refusal by Daniel seems to be on spiritual, not on physical ground. He doesn't seem to be saying, well, that stuff will rot your gut. You know, he didn't seem to be saying, well, if I eat that, I'll be healthy. He was saying, his religion seems to have been involved. It seems to be a moral stand. Now, let me say a word about why would the king appoint a special diet to his civil servants? That's my modern term, civil servants.
A special physical diet just to keep healthy, I guess.
Why do they keep healthy? Well, I'll do the
concern.
Yes, you see, two things. In the ancient world, people died very quickly, very easily. You can die from almost anything. People die from food poisoning regularly. But that's why we say in Roman history, one of the favorite ways of murdering somebody was to poison them, because you couldn't. Because people died so regularly from food poisoning anyway, it'd be hard to prove. Impossible to prove, almost. Now, and these were people they had a lot invested in. A lot of money invested in them. They were very important people. 3 years training. And secondly, you must understand that life was rigorous. These people had to work hard. They had to travel, which was very hard. And so they were important people who had a lot to do. And they, probably another reason was that since they were fed at the king's table, they created a dependence. They would be loyal to the king. That's where your bread and butter comes from. And so there were a number of reasons why they would create this kind of dependency and to make sure they eat this food so they would protect their investment. Now God granted, and so Daniel said, I'd rather not eat this. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion inside of the commander of the officials. This Ashpenaz seems to have been a pretty decent guy. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. Verse 10. For why should he see your faces look more haggard than the youths who are your own age? By youth, he's probably in his 20s, late 20s, maybe early 30s. He was not a teenager, I don't think. Could have been, but not very likely. Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. So look out at Daniel. Daniel says, I'd like to let you eat what you want to eat, but my job is at stake, my life is at stake. You know, what happens? You start looking, the rest of them stay healthy, and you start looking like death warmed over, it's going to be my head. So Daniel asked for a test. Please test your servant for 10 days. Let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Now, why vegetables? Were the ancient Israelites vegetarians? Yeah, this probably points to the fact of the Levitical, of meat sacrificed to idols, and or the Levitical restriction was mostly on meat. Apparently there wasn't any meat that they could eat for whatever reason. So they said, look, what he's basically saying is, let us eat the veggies and stay away from the meat. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence. after this 10-day period, you see. And the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food and deal with your servants according to what you see. Is that fair? Give us 10 days. See how we look. If we're drying up, withering away, why? Okay. Now, but this 10 days seems rather short. Here are a couple of questions. If the distinction was physical, how could 10 days make a noticeable difference? Well, 10 days would make some difference, but you wonder. How could Daniel know? Do you know about divine? Was God directing him in a special way in this? I think possibly. We don't really know. Montgomery calls it a wager of faith. So much information about that, say water. A wager of faith. Water? Yeah, the misspelling of the syllabus. A wager of faith. It seems to be a miraculous testimony of the ability of Daniel's God to bless them in a special and a spectacular way for their refusal to break the law of Moses. That's the best I can. I think Montgomery's right on that. You know, it seems to be that. You got that? We will not. In 10 days, the difference would show up if they were faithful to the law. Now, put this in its largest context. Why was Israel in captivity? Because they broke the law. They would not keep the law of God. They had polluted themselves. So they were there to learn their lesson. Daniel and his friends would be leaders in repentance. You understand? This is the nation repenting. These were to be the leaders of the captive Israelites, captive Jews, right? They were to minister the nation. What was the nation to do in captivity? Repent of its pollution. So, you see what Daniel's doing? He's leading the way. This is the lesson we're supposed to learn. We're captives because we polluted ourselves. So let's start right now to set things right. And perhaps God gave divine revelation in this. He says, let us eat vegetables, literally in the Hebrew, things that are sown. I've already talked about this. Well, verses 14 through 16 shows the success of the trial. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the king's youths who had been eating the king's choice food. The word fatter simply means filled out. They were ruddy. They were vigorous. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. As for these four youths, God, now end of verse 17, the Hebrew youths entered government service. As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. That is, he divinely increased their learning ability. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Now here you find a case where God deals with people as they are. Visions and dreams were used by God in the ancient world for special revelations because that's how the people thought and they operated. And one of the things the kings believed that they ruled on behalf of the gods and that the gods communicated with them a number of ways, not the least of which was their dreams. Remember Pharaoh in Egypt, where God did communicate through dreams. So, anytime a king had a dream, the standard SOP, standard operating procedure, was for the king to call in his advisors, his counselors, his soothsayer, whatever you want to call them, whatever he called them, to interpret that dream, as we're going to see Nebuchadnezzar did. No matter what it was, I mean, if they had too much taco sauce the night before and had a nightmare, they would interpret that sucker. Why? Because they were special representatives of God and they didn't know what it meant. So, interpreting of dreams was a big part of, if you were an advisor to the king, as Daniel and his friends were, a big part of it was interpreting the dreams. It was ancient hermeneutics. I'm sorry, serious. Hermes was the messenger of the gods, where the term hermeneutics came from. If you got a dream, why? The ordinary people would have dreams. They were just dreams. But the king had a dream. It was God speaking, or the gods speaking. So God gave Daniel special abilities in this area. Then at the end of the days, this is the 3 years, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked to him, interviewed him, checked him out, asked him questions, put him on the hot seat. And out of them all, probably several hundred
from different nations,
out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Mishael, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. What does that mean? They became cabinet members. They had been trained just to be general low-level civil servants. But now, what he did was he interviewed them, took the best, and made them his counselors. As I would say, a cabinet. President's cabinet. They were.
Did your translation say personal service?
Yes. Now, what which meant, by the way, that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah became four of the most powerful men on earth, as far as their influence is concerned. See how, and that's how God has always done it. Notice how God puts people in high places. I talked about this before, did I not? The Ethiopian eunuch, the Magi, Joseph, Nehemiah, powerful men in high places. And as for every matter, verse 20, of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better. Now he didn't measure, that's a Hebrew way of writing. He's not talking mathematics, he's talking hyperbole. 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers that were in his realm. And Daniel continued to the first year of Cyrus, that is, Daniel held this position all the way through the end, until the end of the Babylonian Empire. That is, he took the position in 601, probably. If you went in captivity in 605, or 606, let's say 605, and then he was in training for 3 years, you have a year to play with, and you're probably down to 601, 600. And then you count down to 538 B.C. This is important because you understand that when Daniel, when we come to Belshazzar's feast at the end of this Babylonian Empire, 539 B.C., 538, Daniel's an old man. See, just figure it out. Let's count from the year 600 B.C. down to 538. And that, of course, is 62 years. And if he was 20, which would be the minimum, I think, when he entered the service, he's at least 82 years old. When he interpreted the handwriting on the wall. And then he continued after that in the reign in the court of Cyrus. Persians took him back. It's interesting, isn't it? And one of the real studies, this would be good to preach on in Florida, is how many old people got used, and how many people he didn't use till they were old. He really didn't start using Moses till he was 80. Abraham and Sarah, Zachariah, why didn't pick old people? Zachariah and Elizabeth. It's interesting, isn't it? He prepares them. Daniel's young and using him here, but he uses him when he's young and when he's old. You know, I think that the I think this is important to think about in especially talking in Florida, so many retirees. Our modern culture, which has translated its fear of death into a worship of youth, creates the impression that when you're old, you're done for, and a lot of people believe it. And they quit. And if you're in the local ministry, you get some people, one of the real problems you have, you get people who used to serve the church well for years, and they retired and everything. I mean, they became spectators. And they want to be entertained in the church, and they're done. Part of it's not their fault, part of it, this is the culture talking to them. Now you can go too far. Who was it? One entertainment, who was this about a writer that asked him how he wanted to die? It may have been Patton. Well, how he wanted to die, he said he wanted to live till he was maybe find him and be shot by a jealous husband. Well, I think that's going a little bit too far. But
George Burns.
George Burns
is 105 or something. Is that what he said? The same basic.
Well, the point is that that's not a biblical approach to things. Because what happens is often older people have experience and wisdom that can really be valuable, but they just feel like, well, I'm done. See that? Well, Daniel served God. This is a great lesson. You find Daniel serving God when he's young, but you find him serving his own as well. Well, now, we got 3 minutes left, according to my watch. I think we'll not start on chapter 2. We just barely get started and have to stop. So, I'm not assigning more reading. You've read through chapter 2 if you don't read. So I won't assign any more reading for Friday. Those of you who didn't get it done, try to get that done. Any questions?